Last May, when I was visiting in Gurgaon in New Delhi, India, around the time of Swami Kriyananda's birthday, in fact, the very day that I arrived, which was May 12th, Swamiji invited the staff, which is basically all those who live in the ashram there, to come to his house, and he had a video that someone had taken of the flower gardens at Crystal Hermitage, which is his home up at Ananda Village. And so he invited them over to see the flowers, and he had just come to New Delhi from Pune, where he'd been living, so people hadn't seen him for a while, and of course I had just arrived. And so after we looked at the flowers, he just sat in his chair with everyone crowded around him, and for half an hour or so he was just having satsang, just talking about spiritual things. And we had just watched about a half an hour of close-up photographs of flowers, in which you're looking right into the heart of tulips and sometimes roses, mostly tulips because it was the spring season. I'm reminded in this sense when someone asked Georgia O'Keeffe why she would paint flowers that were so tiny in real life into these huge canvases, her answer was, "That's how they look to me," which I thought was a marvelous response, just to see the world so differently. So we'd just been looking at all these beautiful flowers, and really without any explanation, Swami made the comment that how extraordinary it is that all of this complexity of creation comes out of pure simplicity. And of course, we often say, God is simple, everything else is complex. And those ideas are almost like sentimental aphorisms. And so Swami just mentioned, he said, God is simple. Like that, God is the heart of simplicity. And then the next day, after everyone had gone, we were having breakfast or whatever we were doing, and he said very casually, he said, "I think that remark sailed over the heads of almost everyone." He said it was far deeper than most people realized. Well, it had sailed over my head too, I must confess. I tried to chalk it up to jet lag because I had just arrived, but really it just sailed over my head. So I spent much of that day just contemplating all this complexity comes out of simplicity. The closer you get to God, the simpler it becomes. And then I started thinking of it in these terms. And I wrote this to some of you in a letter, but I've been thinking about it a lot. I'm going to go like this, which might not look like anything to you, but oftentimes when I've tried to explain the subtle thought that Swami offers us, that there was the oneness of spirit, and then spirit vibrated. And that vibration is the sound of Om and the vision of light, and it's the one force in movement. And that movement creates everything that we see. And this is interesting because this being a rising age of Dwapara Yuga, the age of energy, scientists are talking more and more in terms of vibrations, more and more in terms of energy. Understanding that what appears to us to be solid matter is just literally energy vibrating at different rates, which is very much what the Vedas and Swami here is talking about. Here's the oneness of spirit, and it begins to move. Of course, and it moves very fast. If you see a propeller wheel spinning, it moves so fast that it appears to be a solid form, doesn't it? And only when it stopped moving do you realize what was actually happening, because movement itself creates an illusion. And the reason that we can never find satisfaction, as our scripture reading is telling us today, people's least favorite reading is, desires will never satisfy you. Part of us thinks, well, they'll satisfy me if I can just get the right ones. You know, it's just that I have had the wrong ones. It's not a problem with the whole system. But the system is that there's the oneness of spirit and it moves. And of necessity, if it goes this way, it has to go that way. And it's not that in the moment, through our outward concentration, we're not having a relatively speaking good time. But whatever it is, if it's moved this way, it's going to move that way. If we're young and beautiful and energetic and dynamic, we're going to get old and a lot uglier and a lot less dynamic. You know, it's just going to happen. Everything is like that. If we're alive, we're going to die. You know, if we're in positions of power, then we're going to get taken away. A friend of mine, he hasn't suffered from this because of his own nature, but he started a company. He became very well-to-do because of it. He sold the company, actually sold the company twice. The second time he sold the company, he sold himself with it like people do. So he still goes in a couple of times a week, and he says, but now they don't listen to me anymore. That's how he put it. You know, he's the whole reason the company exists, but now they don't listen to me anymore. And he just laughed merrily and said, basically, I'll just go in for a few hours a week and collect my salary. It's no problem for me. But that is what happens to us, isn't it? Everybody listens to us because we're young and dynamic, and then somebody else comes up and they don't listen to us anymore. That's what we're talking about. But you see, what happens is, the closer you get to the heart of spirit, whether we're looking into the heart of a flower and feeling the essence of God behind it, whether we're looking into our own nature and getting deeper and deeper into the heart of who we are, that movement begins to cease. And all that complexity that's created by all this vibration becomes stiller and stiller. You see how simple it is? God is simple. All the complexity emerges from that simplicity. So that philosophical idea is expressed in lots of different ways in terms of how we ourselves should behave as devotees. And this is one of the reasons why in this age, Master Paramahansa Yogananda put so much emphasis on the concept of devotion. Because when we perceive through the mind, and in this particular Gita reading, the intellect, the mind, and desires are considered to be just obstructions to understanding. Now, I've always really liked the intellect. It's been one of my really better friends through my life, I thought. And I'm very fond of intelligence. As Swamiji put it to me once, you value it too much, he said. You know, it's just like intelligent people are just fun for me. I like it. I was delighted when I met Swami Kriyananda because he was so well-educated and so intelligent, especially in 1969 when I first met him. That was the only way I even imagined a human being could be. And I've always considered it a nice perk that he has that quality. But over time, and I'll just digress for a moment to tell you this one thought, I was amazed over the years, and I wrote this into my book about Swami, about his intelligence. I mean, his ability to explain things, to cut through situations, to see the implications, everything we call intelligence, just having the ability to see the world as it is and then articulate it marvelously. But I couldn't understand, because there was a quality to his intelligence that was so different. It was not scholarly, it was not intellectual. It was just a brilliant ability to see things as they are. And I began to watch him, and in fact the experience I had was my own, which was I realized I was having so much trouble understanding what I ought to do in a certain circumstance. And I finally realized one day that the reason I couldn't understand was because I didn't want to understand. Isn't that how it often is? Because I knew perfectly well what, in this case, God was asking of me, and I didn't want to do it. I thought it was a really, really bad idea, and it looked to me like it was going to make me very unhappy, and I was going to have to give up a lot of my desires. So I pretended to be very confused. Because as long as I'm confused, I don't actually have to do anything, do I? I can just want so much to know, but I can't know, but I want to know, but I can't know, and I can just keep going like that. And then when it occurred to me that that was what I was actually doing, I went to Swamiji and I said, the reason I don't understand is because I don't want to understand, isn't that so? He said, yes. I said, as soon as I'm genuinely interested in what is and willing to let go of desire, intellect, and mind, all of those things, then what needs to happen will be obvious. Isn't that so? He said, of course. I'll finish this story by saying, since that time, whenever I've prayed and have been unable to get an answer and felt this confusion about God's will, I always stop asking that question and step back and say, what am I afraid of? What am I attached to? You know, what am I holding on? Because just even that agitation, you see, is a lack of willingness to come into the center. Now, going through that experience myself, I began to contemplate, why is Swami always so incisive, always able to see what's happening? Because he has freedom of heart. He has complete Freedom of heart is where the likes and dislikes of the self are contained. It's our feelings that bind us to one side or another. Isn't that so? If we're just looking at things impersonally, we can talk about other people very easily and see how the waves rise and fall. Isn't it so? Well, yes, he was very powerful and now his day is past, you know. Yes, he was young and beautiful and now he's not. It's very impersonal. But when it's me, that's completely different, isn't it? Because our sense of where our happiness comes from is very much engaged in this is what I'm like and I can't do this and so on. I was speaking to a friend recently and the friend had used the word, this is my nature. And just seeing that, suddenly it occurred to me, no, this is nobody's nature. This is my habit. This is the habit of self-definition that I have. Because as long as we're moving like this, the intellect grabs onto something. But our only nature is infinite. And I realized two things about Swami's intelligence of the heart. And you know, scientifically, they're beginning to verify all this. They're beginning to find that the heart actually physiologically looks a lot like the brain. That people really do think with the heart. Master said, reason follows feeling. Whatever we're predisposed to believe, then we find all these reasons to believe it. And that's why Master puts desire and intellect in the same place. Because intellect can sort of take things apart and put it back together, but as long as any desire is in there, and let's have a lot of respect for delusion in this situation, okay? It's a very formidable enemy. The intellect can tell you you don't have any desires. You see, that's one of its little games. But the very fact that it's doing it is a little bit suspect, let's say that. But Swami's inner reality is transcendent of all of these little preferences. He doesn't identify, as he put it himself once. He said, Swami, I never identify with Swami Kriyananda. I consider him an event for which I am responsible. I think that's such a charming way to think about yourself, isn't it? Because we still have to engage. If you're putting on the party, you have to really be conscientious about putting on that party well. Isn't that so? But you never make the mistake of thinking that that's actually oneself. It's a little bit affected to refer to yourself in the third person, but you can do that inwardly. You know, just think about what he or she is doing and step back a little bit because it's just our habit. But Swami's consciousness is such that all he really wants is to get closer to the one. He doesn't really want to enjoy all the permutations anymore. He just wants to get closer to the one. And his happiness is not dependent on any external condition. So he has this tremendous courage of the heart that just simply asks the question, what is? And then there's a second element of this, which I don't think I wrote into that book, but I realize is so true. It's through the power of pure calm feeling. We have to make a distinction which the English language doesn't make. Swamiji says intuition is calm feeling. And the reason he makes that emphasis is the feeling nature is that which allows us to dissolve our unity and see ourselves as one with the world around us. Isn't that so? The reason Georgia O'Keeffe looks at those flowers and they loom so large to her is because she just enters in to the heart of what that flower is, and all of a sudden it's infinity in a grain of sand to her. And isn't it so when we're relating to people that if we just merely talk to them without any attempt inwardly first to bridge the distance between us, isn't that when our communication really happens? When we both understand and are understood is when we have bridged the difference, the distance? Isn't it the most meaningful thing in the world to you when people actually, we use slang words like, so-and-so really gets me. He really, meaning that he really understands who I am. And that understanding doesn't come because he's explained himself to me and I've explained myself to him or like that. It's because we just are. Isn't that how a parent feels about the baby? I mean, isn't that why that power of love is so extraordinary? Because there just is no difference. I remember watching the first friend of mine who had a toddler when I was in my late teens, and she was chasing her baby all over the house, and all I could think of is, my God, how can you do this? It just seemed we couldn't finish a sentence. And of course, it was very important to me to have intelligent conversation. She was chasing this little creature all over the house, and we couldn't, you know, go two thoughts together. And I finally just burst out, even though I like children. How can you stand this? She gave me a beautiful answer. She said, you look at this, my son and me, and you see two, she said, there's only one here. You know, it's just that my sense of self is so completely in his, there's no sense of even my doing anything. Now, isn't that what it is that we're always looking for? Isn't that the source of our loneliness? Is that no matter how hard we try, we're always standing here just by ourselves? Now, in our relationships to people, we tend to think that what people want from us is something other than that. Now, when God comes to the center like this, and when we feel that Spirit of God, yes, great wisdom may come to us, but not great complexity of reason. What comes to us is wisdom, which is the direct perception, transcending the intellect, of the way things are. And the power of the saints, there's this story about Ananda Moyi Ma, who was a great saint in India. She lived until 1982. She's sort of an honorary mother to our spiritual path. Yogananda was very close with her, wrote about her in Autobiography of a Yogi, the chapter, The Joy Permeated Mother. Swami Kriyananda spent years, much time in Ananda Moyi Ma's company. She was a simple Indian woman. She was illiterate. She never even learned to read. She signed her name by making a little dot. You know, whenever so often when something would have to be signed, she'd just make a dot. She could not write her own name. But great scholars would come to her and she would explain to them the meaning of the scriptures that she would have read out loud to her because she couldn't read them herself. She never bothered to learn to read because reading was a lower way of gaining understanding. You read the words and they're there and then you think about what they might mean and you examine what each of those little words are and you try to understand the nuances and then you look them up in the dictionary and then you try to put the thoughts together and then finally you say, oh, I get it. God is simple, you know, like that. But what we're trying to understand is what is our true nature? How do we fit into this world? How do we relate to all those around us? Who am I? Where does my happiness come from? Now, when we get close to the divine spirit, when we get out of all this moving back and forth, it comes down to this one simple truth. You are my own beloved. I have been and always will be thine own. This French saint said, if you knew how much God loves you, you would die for joy. Just imagine what that must mean. I mean, you're just sitting here and suddenly you know how much God loves you and everything is so satisfied that you just walk out of your body. I mean, he's not really saying that, but maybe so. Or no, there was a funny skit they did at Ananda Village, the story of this man who had all these different desires, and one of them was to have a beautiful wife. And he had a beautiful wife, but she died young, so he wasn't happy. So in his next life, he wanted a beautiful wife that lived longer and so on like this. But the way they did it in the skit was so cute. He's there with his beloved wife, and he says, oh, darling, listen to this beautiful phrase. If you knew how much God loves you, you would die for joy. And she went, fell over dead, just like that. But if so, and the reason he puts it that way is because what keeps us in our bodies is this thought that we can finally have what we want through this body. I mean, in other words, we have misunderstandings about our true nature, that's what karma is. So we have all these experiences we have to keep living out. If we suddenly realize that all of that external seeking, all that analysis of what the world is like, all this moving through the world by taking it apart and then putting it back together, all of this restless sense of incompletion that we think we're going to solve in this way or this way or this way or this way. I have absolutely loved getting older. I just am thrilled by getting older because I can look back and sort of see a progression. And there's a relaxation to not being quite so young anymore that I treasure. And I try to visualize myself as a very old child next time if I have another body. You know, if I'm going to try to become a Jivan Mukta, Swamiji promises us we can, which is to say, to become free of the compulsion. But just in case, I try to think of myself as a very old child. I want everyone to say to me when I'm a little child, you were an old woman from the day you were born. That's what I want. You know, not in the sense of being dull or tired, but just having that perspective. Because you look back, one, everyone looks back on their life, and you see how all of that inner restlessness caused you to think, I have to have this, I have to have that. You know, if I could only do this, if I could only do that. Now, many of those desires are implanted in us by the divine in the sense that we're not ever going to understand until we live through it. So even as the Bhagavad Gita says, it doesn't do any good to say, I don't really want it, I don't really want it, I don't, I don't, I don't. You know, if it's the energy that's coming through us, and, you know, our desire for human love and to have children and to have partners and so on is one of the most profound, and it's one of the biggest delusions in a certain sense, but it's also planted to us in us by God, because by those experiences we will gradually understand the difference between this constant back and forth movement and the simple stillness of spirit. Because what happens, Swamiji writes in, it's the Material Success Course, the class that we're teaching now in Lesson 2, he writes how sooner or later we will all come to a state of God realization, that we will all want only God. He said, not because God will make us want that, but because we ourselves will begin to see it's the only desire that fulfills us. And in the meantime, we feel this restless sense of incompleteness. And then our senses, this is the Gita talking to us, our senses look out, and the mind says, oh, if I could just have that new dress, I would just feel a lot better. Oh, you know, it just bothers me so much, the color of this kitchen. If we could just paint the walls, it would be better. Oh, the problem is I'm so alone. If I just had a friend, I would be better. And then we start moving out from the center. Instead of coming back into the sense of simple stillness, where our contentment really lies, we start moving out into this reality. And we have to, in a sense, because it has to be a state of actual realization. It can't be somebody forcing that thought onto you. But listen to the scriptures and listen to what they say. That at a certain point, when we feel that restless sense of incompleteness, the soul then says, go deeper into the simple one. No longer seek it by multiplying your options. Now, even then, and I have to just add one last point, Swami Kriyananda has lived one of the most creative, active lives of anybody that we know. He's lived 50 incarnations in just one, doing so many different things. So it's not as if when we come down to that one point, we become still. Yes, there are yogis and saints who really do nothing but meditate. Ram Gopal Muzumdar, described in Autobiography of a Yogi, 25, 30 years just living up in a cave. St. Anthony of the Desert, decades living in the tombs, just doing nothing but meditating. It is a path. On our path, we have the opposite example. We have these souls that once they come to the perfect simplicity, then from that state of perfect simplicity, they do this multitudinous of things. But the movement is always not from the mind, not from desire, not from the intellect figuring it out, but from God moving the heart. Everything is complex. God is simple, because God is a simple one truth. I was raised in Judaism, and even though we were not very active, I remember fragments of it. The rabbi, every Friday or Saturday service, Hear, O Israel, meaning to the tribes of Israel, the chosen people. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. It's a very profound prayer. Hear, those of you who have chosen to live a spiritual life, there is only one. Make it simple. The mind can go in 1,000 directions, but when it finally settles down, there will be one truth. I am one with the infinite spirit, and everything is a part of that divinity.